Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It's CJ. Hopefully, everyone's having a fantastic day. It is Tuesday, December the 13th, and it's that time of the week again for another edition of The Great Game with Matthew Arrett. Do us a favor, if you have not done so yet, jump over to thecanadianpatriot.org. All the links are in the description where you can follow all of Matthew's work, the Canadian Patriot, as well as the Rising Tide Foundation, and also to make sure to visit his Substack as well. With that being said, Matthew, great day. How are you, sir?
Hey, CJ. I'm doing okay. Thank you. And I love the new intro. As always, there's always something new that you throw into it for a creative edge. So I appreciate that. There's a lot to go through, man. I mean, I know we were just chatting a little bit back and forth on Telegram about the different angles. I had some thoughts regarding the developments on the in the midst of the Heartland and McIntyre's World Island, which has historically been a major spark plug for arsonists out to try to impose chaos with the hope that order could then be brought in out of said chaos. Serbia is obviously what I'm referring to at the moment, but obviously the entire Balkan zone, including in the northern region into Ukraine, is a factor. But this it's not an easy thing on the surface to sort of dance around, it helps to put your mind into the disgusting vicarious skull of a Halford Mackinder type of grand strategist, and just think, when a British imperialist is looking at a map of the world, how are they thinking, right? How are they strategizing? And from that standpoint, when you look at the very ethnically diverse multicultural matrix of not just Russia, which has something like 118 different ethnic groups, languages, sub-dialects, but also all the way down into the Caucasus, Central Asia, Eastern Europe. You're dealing with Albanians, Bulgarians, Hungarians, Poles. You got Estonians, Latvians. I mean, there's so many groups, and then subgroups, some of which are Catholic, some are Muslim. I mean, a lot of Albanian Muslims right now are in Kosovo. It used to be mostly Serbs, but it's still a region in Kosovo, you know, with some pseudo autonomy, kind of like a Taiwan. You know, it's a province of China, but it has special autonomous privileges, not really a country, but it's obviously How is it that a geopolitical manipulator would be looking at these things and thinking, how can they inflame prejudices for their own benefit? And I think it was Lord Palmerston who said it best, that the British Empire never has permanent friends, only permanent interests.
Yeah.
And I think that helps us sort of like negotiate, or at least get our minds around some of the seeming support that Anglo-American operatives, you know, Anthony Blinken was just in Kosovo a couple of months back. As soon as he left after meeting with the leadership, all of a sudden you've got a strange set of provocative maneuvers, clampdowns on the minority Serbs who live there by the National Endowment for Democracy government, which had obviously been given certain guarantees and promises to be allowed quick entry into the European Union that they've long been longing for, into NATO, which, I mean, technically Serbia is part of NATO, but they really want to have more foreign Western controls, and also that guarantee Kosovo's independence as a sovereign state, right? Kosovo tried to declare independence back in the 90s. The Serbian government saw it as an insurrectionary thing, which I think it was. There was, in response to retaliation, there was in response to the Serbian government trying to bring order to the separatist movement, there was a giant unilateral NATO bombing that killed upwards of 13,000 people in the 90s. First time NATO was really used for those purposes. We saw, after Blinken left back, I think it was in, I want to say September, that's when you really started having this push to start forcing everybody to use Kosovo license plates, even though most of the countries of the world, including the United Nations, don't recognize Kosovo as an independent country. So, I mean, for, you know, this not independent country, this province of Serbia, demanded that all people start using Kosovo independence license plates. which the Serbs who live there are like, no, we don't want to do that. That's illegal and against our conscience. So it, this turned into more of a crackdown. Different forces began putting a lot of pressure on these people, threats. It has danced with violence. There were shoots that rang out between both sides during a blockade that began last week between police officers and people who were demonstrating that they are part of Serbia. Vucic, the president of Serbia, has basically said, you know, look, NATO, we're part of NATO. Do we have a right to deploy our own NATO troops to restore order in a part of our own sovereign territory? And of course, the Baerbock said, no, that is completely unacceptable. Which is weird. If you're a member of NATO, you'd think you have the right to use NATO troops according to NATO policy to.
You would think, right? Yeah, you would think.
But no, not at all. So the hypocrisy, I mean, the self-contradictions of the system just keep on coming out more and more. Bosnia-Herzegovina has just been fast entry into the European Union as well today, which is not in and of itself odd since it's been like a decade they've been trying. But the fact that the EU all agreed now today to do it at the moment when things are as hot as they are in Kosovo is not a coincidence. And it, and the fact that, you know, even Vucic said, well, how are you going to be allowed entry into the EU when you're not even recognized as a sovereign country by the European Union?
Yeah.
And the UN. So the whole thing's a mess, but it's obviously being manipulated. These groups are being given promises that they're going to have all sorts of privileges, guarantees, other things. And there's a high inflaming of ethnic nationalist prejudices. So this I think gets us back a little bit more into World War I, because what was the spark plug of this insane war? It was, on the one hand, you could say a terrorist movement of Serbia that was deployed to kill an Austrian archduke that had jurisdiction over Serbia. You know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that time had a certain amount of influence in Serbia, a lot actually. So the Archduke Ferdinand was killed by the Serbian group called the Black Hand. And we're told then within a month, everybody was at war killing each other. Now that's an overly simplified lie. Those who were actually the actual terrorists, the three individuals who were found guilty and arrested and were interrogated before being executed for that kill of Archduke Ferdinand, we're making the point, number one, the reason why Archduke Ferdinand was a target was, one, because he was resisting the greater Serbia agenda, which these people were all believers in devoutly, that Serbia was not just this little territory, but actually had the God-given right to go back a few centuries into the past where there was a broader Serbian empire. And they had this mythos that was cooked up for them and that turned into a bit of a blood and soil cult about this idea of the greater Serbia, which included a territory like six times bigger. And they were saying, oh, this Duke was against that. And when they were pushed even further, this was recorded, their testimony in interrogation, they made the point that it was a Freemasonic operation that they were deployed to carry out, a Freemasonic hit. They name names, they go through the whole thing, they talk about the Grand Orient Lodge that had been organized by the United Grand Lodge of Britain, of England. They point out who the key controllers were within Serbia. Joseph Bruda, who's a former writer for EIR, actually documented and had a big chunk of this transcription. But what was clearly communicated, and all evidence points to this, is that there's higher agendas manipulating the scene. It's very similar to today. And it's not just today that you have these different groups being manipulated, but also you have, Georgia has been an area right next door, which went to war with Russia for about 5 days back in 2008. Thank God Saakashvili is out. But if you had a sort of Soros movement like that back in play, then in Georgia, then they could easily try to take South Ossetia, at which point you get Russia being pulled in yet again. You've got Belarus, which just signed an agreement to unify the military forces between Belarus and Russia as a common defense. You got Russia, which has been forced to say in response to Angela Merkel, who, you know, just came out admitting that they were lying, that she was completely disgenuine throughout Minsk 1, Minsk 2 in 2014-15. She just pretty much just said, like, yeah, we were buying time for Ukraine to build up their forces so that they could take back all their territory and go to war with Russia. And she said, if we just allowed them to do that back in 2015, they would have been crushed by Russia. But what a great job we did by deflecting attention away of the Russians and buying them the time to receive the support they need, as if they're somehow not getting their asses kicked right now. As if, so Russia's had to come out saying, well, look, this, we don't know who to, how do you talk to people who lie to this extent? And, you know, Putin has said, well, we have to even go so far as to reevaluate our first strike nuclear policy in light of this sort of thing. And in light of the fact that Biden also reneged on his promises to not use a nuclear weapons first strike, especially on non-nuclear targets, which Biden explicitly did in his National Defense Authorization bill, the most recent one, where he basically reserved the right to attack non-nuclear targets. So you have all of this heating up on so many different levels. And so to go back again to what is it that is the logic of the empire? I mean, you had quite the Kaiser Wilhelm, the guy who got pulled into this thing from the German side back in World War One. He said it directly. He said right in August 1914, right at the beginning of the war, he said, England, Russia, and France have agreed among themselves to take the Austro-Serbian conflict for an excuse for waging a war of extermination against us. That is the real naked situation, slowly and cleverly set going by Edward VII, who was sort of the grandmaster Freemasonic operative who was carrying out a lot of these different things and had his own family members deployed as the crown, the different agents on various crowns, including the Greek crown. You had so many that, I mean, Bulgaria had a Prince Saxe-Coburg Gotha that Britain had placed on their crown in 1887. You had, what was another one? The Romanian crown had Queen Victoria's granddaughter placed on that crown as the queen. So you had the British royal bloodlines, which themselves go back a very, I mean, this goes back to the Hanoverian dynasty, the Denmark dynasties. It goes back to Venice. It goes back a long way before even the name Windsor ever came about. But they had basically ensured that their operatives, their agents were instituted in these various governments with the same type of prejudices that they were inflaming of greater Albania, greater Bulgaria, greater Hungary, greater Greece. And they were even doing the same thing on the other side in the Ottoman so-called enemy territory, promoting the greater Turkey idea under the Young Turks. So this is sort of how the game was played. They inflamed these ideological cults around ethno-nationalism, which saw, which had a romantic idea of past heroisms going back 1,000 years into the past in some cases, of, you know, that was again just pure romanticism. They did the same thing in Ukraine, that they wanted to bring back this idea that our ethnic stock is superior to the inferior ethnic stocks that we want to wipe out. So Edward VII was a key figure manipulating this. Again, going back to Kaiser Wilhelm, he said Edward VII finally brought this to a conclusion by George V, Edward's son, the new king presiding over World War I. And so the famous encirclement of Germany has finally become a fact, despite every effort of our politicians and diplomats to prevent it. The net has been suddenly thrown over our heads, and England steeringly reaps the most brilliant success of her persistently prosecuted, purely anti-German world policy against which we have proved ourselves helpless, while she twists the noose of our political and economic destruction out of our fidelity to Austria, as we squirm isolated in the net. A great achievement, which arouses the admiration even of him who is to be destroyed as its result. He's speaking pathetically of himself, right? He's like, wow, what a great grand scheme, even though I'm about to be destroyed. Edward the Seventh is, or Edward is stronger after his death than I am, who am still alive. Now that's the king. That's Kaiser Wilhelm II. Ironically, a cousin of Edward the Seventh, and you know, a fool, just like Tsar Nicholas II also was enmeshed in the royal family of Britain through his wife. So all of these people are inbred cousins. They were all placed there, some dupes, some fools, some openly aware agents. And after the Serbian Black Hand, which, by the way, was, for those who haven't gotten it, not just Freemasonic, it was part of British intelligence, as and also the Okhrana, the Russian secret police that were created as a Jesuitical Freemasonic operation inside of Moscow itself in the 1880s to stop the advent of the pro-Lincoln Russian patriots around Alexander II and III, who were both assassinated. This grouping was then deployed with many other anarchist groups all over North America, all over Europe, to basically carry out hits, assassinations of high value political targets. McKinley, President McKinley, was one of them. You had very many, I would say several dozen leading statesmen were killed, as well as just basically creating an atmosphere of terror, kind of like what the world has been put under after 9/11, especially, was this state of, you know, public explosions in markets that would just polarize the people and make them more malleable to handlers who controlled these different idiot groups who often didn't know how they were being handled or how they were being used and deployed. But again, the key ideology of many of these anarchist terror groups was this idea of young Europe, young Croatia, young Switzerland, young Bulgaria, young Serbia, young Turkey. It was often imbued with this type of insanity, and when they could create such a conflict, when the chaos was just ripe, then there were certain top-down agreements that were initiated in secret, usually by British foreign policy, British diplomacy, that had made sure that things like the Entente Cordiale was arranged, which is what Kaiser Wilhelm is referring to here. You know, that was basically the secret agreement that Germany didn't know about, which involved Russia, France, and England all agreeing that any time that there should be a war, all three would jump in. And when Austria basically demanded that the Serbian government crack down on the terrorist movements and make certain other reforms, well, were accommodated. The Serbian government said, okay, let's do it. And despite that, you had some psychopaths within Austria who said, no, we don't accept that. We don't accept those reforms that you're giving us. We want, and they were pretty much, as we discovered later on, British operatives who were just idiot fools, kind of like the neocons, who had promises that they would receive a giant expanse of new territory if they could just help initiate a war with Serbia. Because they had been promised, they were in the know that England and France would jump on board with Russia in any type of war. Now, Serbia had an agreement with Russia. So if Serbia were to get into conflict, Russia would have to come in as sort of the big brother and back them up. Well, in the same measure, Austria had a similar agreement with Germany that any type of conflict they got into, Germany would come and back them up. And these various, like the prime minister of Austria, the foreign minister of Austria, were these fanatics, Freemasonic connected, again, kind of like the neocons. And they basically said, no, we're going to go to war with Serbia. And as soon as this got hot, then all of a sudden Germany got pulled into the war. And that was always the target, get Russia and Germany to destroy each other. And Britain could have at any time stopped this from happening. All they had to say was, well, you know, they just had to tell the Germans that that they have the secret agreement with France and Russia, and definitely that would have stopped it. But there's all of this. And Britain also was the first nation to prepare for the war, all the way even before the assassination of the Archduke. They were already building up their naval forces in preparation for the war. Germany of World War I was the very last country to start preparing for the war. They were the last to know, as we could hear from the pathetic words of the Kaiser. So why was Germany and Russia the targets? And why was this zone in the middle used as a hotbed? Well, they were the targets because you had in Russia and in Germany the most enthusiastic embrace of Abraham Lincoln's policies, right? We know that from the 1870s, especially 1860s, when Russia came in and saved the United States in the middle of the Civil War. They didn't just save the United States at all, as and then leave. They didn't do that, though they did save the U.S. That's an important thing. They had like Russian naval ships off of the Atlantic and the Pacific coast with, you know, celebrations of Russian troops down the streets of San Francisco and of New York. And you could see etchings, you could see photographs, you could, I mean, read speeches by Lincoln's main guests, who were then saying like, this is the most amazing thing, which is turning the tide of the Civil War, because Russia was basically telling the British and the French that your secret agreements to help back up and join this the Southern slave power in the war openly is going to be seen as a casus belli against Russia. But that kept them out of it. That gave Lincoln an edge he needed. He also had a very strong understanding through people like Henry C. Carey of Hamiltonian greenbacks, Hamiltonian banking, which were deployed in force with the greenback system. That was based upon the idea that money was going to be used as a servant for the elevation of the quality of life and productive powers of the people. You know, you had protectionism of a very high rate that basically every country had the right to use, but only the United States had really pioneered the use of protectionism to cultivate and grow the industrial base so that the country was not dependent upon a monopoly overseas to control who makes your textiles, your machine tools, the things. So, you know, all of these things worked together, and Russia saw, coming out of the American Civil War experience, how effective these policies had been to not just unify a society that had formerly been kind of at war with itself on many points, going back even to this, to the American War of War of Independence. You know, you had various states early on basically at odds, at war with each other, right, not agreeing on any common policy, not able to coordinate each other's actions to do anything. It was basically going to be screwed. And they were highly underdeveloped. They had no real viable modern infrastructure, no manufacturing. So they were able to go from that into, within 80 years, by the time the Civil War rolls around, and then a little bit after, the most advanced productive nation in the world, even rivaling and surpassing Great Britain on almost every measurable economic front you can imagine, but without using vast slave labor. They were not doing colonialism, not really. They had done wrong things. I'm not trying to say that. But unlike Britain, they weren't using the type of rapacious approach to, you know, extracting wealth from India or other things. They were actually using, in the best American traditions, the powers of the mind of highly qualified, highly educated, highly moral citizens who were participating in what they understood to be God's creation. That you were interfacing God by making discoveries, applying them to the productive processes, making inventions, making the life better for your kids. That was a sacred thing. It wasn't just econometric modeling for worshiping of money. So that worked so damn well. And everybody, all of the, I mean, coming out of the Civil War, all of the veterans found work, not all, but so many found work, employment, the nation was able to rehabilitate. And Russia was just looking, as well as Germany, thinking, damn, they have so many parallels to us. They have done what we need to do. And they, and then Russia and Germany brought delegates to the United States, studied how they did it, brought those delegates back to Germany, where you had the policies of what's known as the Frederick List Society. Anybody who wants to know about this American system of Hamilton and of Lincoln, just read Frederick List, a German patriot and economist who studied in America, lived there for 5 years, came in with Marquis de Lafayette, was part of the international Republican networks, and basically took that Hamiltonian approach of unifying the nation around a common idea of the general good and rail development, other things, and then brought it to Germany to unify the Balkanized German state that had no unifying character. And they did that under what was called the Zollverein. That was what Otto von Bismarck ended up really embracing. No British free trade bullshit. He was like, we need protectionism. We got to direct credit for rail, canals, schools, arts, other things that are going to bring the cultural standards to a higher level of wisdom and do it in a way that involves peacemaking. And he made sure under Bismarck's lead that there was always diplomatic bridge building on every front, that Germany was not going to get pulled into one of these spider webs of British intrigue. And it was only when Bismarck was ousted that finally you had an incompetence level that was sufficiently high that allowed for the stupid Kaiser to start agreeing to policies that pulled and enmeshed Germany ever more deeply into unwinnable quagmires, like their own Vietnams were set up in the Balkans. Same thing in Russia. You know, you had Mendeleev, you had leading Republican statesmen around Cassius Clay, Lincoln's U.S. ambassador to Russia, who were bringing in this policy for the Trans-Siberian Railway, protectionism, all the stuff with an outlook towards, especially working with France, who at that time still had better people, and especially Germany, but also the Ottoman Empire, that was realizing that they needed to industrialize and modernize fast. So they were building the Berlin to Baghdad Railway under Otto von Bismarck's lead. And that would have involved basically undoing the type of economic despair that was needed to mobilize by the British side disenfranchised, abused young idiots into the Young Turks movement, which was sort of paralleling the Young Serb, Young Hungary movements and other things to basically weaponize young people the way that the color revolutionaries have done today in Iran, the way that they're doing them all over the world today. Is you take economic despair, where there's economic incompetence and despair, lack of hope, you have a breeding ground for radicalism, an ethno-nationalism, other forms of radicalism that can be used as a controlled opposition to undermine the viability of nation state development. So that was what was done then. And ultimately what we saw was just that, right? We had all of these allies who had everything in common to work together. The French, the Germans, the Russians, all with so much in common, all very quickly being induced to slaughter each other unnecessarily on behalf of who? Well, the empire needs no permanent friends, just permanent allies, or permanent interests. That's it. Not even allies, permanent interests. So you could throw away somebody when they're not useful to you. You know, like, do we think the Anglo-Americans who are utilizing this policy today are going to, do they cherish their German allies? Hells no. Look what they're doing. Oh, Germany is right. Being destroyed, right?
Yeah.
They got warming centers now. Where Germans are just being forced, well, if you can't afford heating, as most can't increasingly, you can go to these like official little warming centers and try not to freeze to death over the winter time. You know, they're even being told like all of the agreements that you had with China, which is offering you all of these economic opportunities to break out of the controls of the Western, you know, death cult. Well, you're not allowed to work with that anymore. You have to like start sanctioning China, canceling your contracts with Chinese companies, kicking out or forcing Chinese companies to divest, as is the case also in Canada, where, you know, like, oh yeah, we're told, yeah, we're an Anglo-American special interest zone. We're the friends of the Anglo-Americans. What? We're being told like China has offered every opportunity for us to have millions of productive jobs, building up infrastructure into the Arctic. They offer to invest billions on Belt and Road initiatives for North America. And in all cases, the Canadian government has come in with a Privy Council office, forcing Chinese companies that do have mining interests in Canada to divest, sell it all off to get kicked out if they had won contracts to have any type of interest over construction companies that were going bankrupt because we're not building anything. China came in, they tried to buy up Aecon Inc. not that long ago. All of the shareholders were desperate and were happy that finally their company was going to get to build some infrastructure in Canada and around the world. And the Privy Council came in saying, no, this is national security, you're not allowed. And so Aecon Inc. is allowed to rot because we're not allowed to build anything under the death cult idea of degrowth. So, you know, there are no real permanent interests, permanent friendships under the imperial logic. And the same thing for Kosovo or in Georgia or in Ukraine. They don't care about the Ukrainian people or the radicals right now who are giving all these promises to have an independent Ukraine sovereign country if they could liberate themselves from the evil Ruskies and stuff. No, that's not going to be maintained. They're going to be expected to be exterminated and subdued under a one world government of a highly reduced global population level. And you see that with Zelensky. He just sold off most of Ukraine to BlackRock, to the World Economic Forum crowd. Mm-hmm. It's now like, what are you fighting for at this point, right?
It's interesting, looking back through history and their ability to, work through some of those things. We had statesmen, we had an understanding of things of mutual benefit, where now you have NATO who says that you must suffer for the greater good of NATO, all the European bloc, the Germans. And it speaks volumes in terms of what they're willing to do, the sacrifice of humanity for their ideals. And instead of transitioning, and it's such a shame, because I think that with the latest events unfolding, it appears to be almost an act of desperation that they've realized that Ukraine is a failure. So now they have to change war footings at some point, Matthew. And it's very interesting right now what's evolving.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, absolutely. I mean, on so many fronts, like you have these various, it is increasingly clear, and you can listen to Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter. I think their analysis is pretty good in terms of like analyzing on the ground developments in Ukraine, how clear it is that Ukraine is, no matter how many billions, I mean, what are they at now? Like, I think in the National Defense Authorization Act bill, it was like another nearly $1 billion, $880 million. But that adds on to what is now well over $40 billion of U.S. Weapons, as well as other forms of support that we're not supposed to talk about. Same thing for Britain, which has openly been—they've actually come out openly saying or at least talking about some of the different on the ground. Boots on the ground operatives who have been doing special operations in Ukraine. That was just this week, but that's been going on now for a long time, on top of the mercenaries and other things that have been deployed in there to basically just light the place on fire and use. You got to really feel for a lot of the civilians of West Ukraine, not just, men, not just the women and children, but I mean, a lot of the men, they don't have their heart in the game to go to war with the Russians or to work alongside Nazis, but they're basically being told, well, we're going to take you out back into the forest and execute you if you don't play along with this and go to the front lines with insufficient training and other things. And your family too, for that matter, which has been happening. There's been a lot of executions of those who have been defiant and not willing to fight to the last man, as Lindsey Graham has said. The U.S. is willing to get the Ukrainians to fight to the last man. And those who haven't, many have been executed. We've got disgusting video footage of the Ukrainian Nazis throwing their own people into mass graves that they've killed for basically speaking out, or even trying to raise a white flag in the middle of an unwinnable battle with the Russians. So rather than getting like bombed to death, those who have tried to surrender have also gotten killed en masse. Some have been successful and have told the tale to the Russians and others of what happened to their colleagues when they tried to surrender. But we have like a really disgusting thing going on. So, I mean, everybody is disposable right now. And what I liked, as you said, it is a lot of acts of desperation. I mean, before I say what I liked, Zelensky even said, we want peace, and the best way to achieve peace, he just said this to the G7 last night, is to increase your weapon support to us.
Yeah, that's the route to peace. That's the route to peace, is more weapons, Matthew. Yeah. More weapons.
And also bomb Iran while you're at it. That's how we're going to get peace. He actually said, like him, the Zelensky networks have actually said, his personal advisor, others have said, if we want to actually have peace, NATO has to finally bomb Iran, because Iran is providing the drones to the Russians. And the level of insanity here on so many levels. So you have just where is this getting interesting? Is we talked about the self-contradictions of the system. Well, the Trilateral Commission just had one of their recent meetings where one of the first times they actually allowed some journalists from Nikkei Asia to come in and view and report upon some of the proceedings, not with names, but it's kind of like a pseudo Bilderberger group run that was founded by David Rockefeller back in the 70s and Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski. So they've been doing regular meetings, and the idea as well, it's as Alex Craner has made the point, that it's sort of like the trifecta general alliance controlling the New World Order. It would be, like just like Hitler with the British, that under the transhuman fascist New World Order of the 1940s, had that not been aborted, the world would have been divided up by, like, you know, Germany controlling Eastern Southern Europe, and also like Russia as a big slave colony. The Anglo-American crowd that would have killed Roosevelt by then would have been in control of Western Europe and North America. Franco would have had some jurisdiction over, obviously, Spanish-speaking parts of Latin America. Mussolini, same thing, especially over big chunks of Africa. And Japan would have been the jurisdictional control of most of Asia, most of Oriental Asia. So that was sort of, and Alex Craner does a really great job just going through how that same strategy is still on the books, just retweaked a little bit to remove Germany. So under the NATO policies, you know, like keep Germany down, Russia out. And that's been sort of what's been the policy ever since. So the Trilateral Commission was set up to basically be that, you know, how this Trilat system was going to manage the world order. And what's interesting, but by the Nikkei Asia reporters is, and you could, anybody could just go to Alex Craner, go to his Substack, Trend Compass Substack, and read, I think it's the fourth article from the most recent. They actually reported how various Japanese, various South Korean, various Malaysian high officials who have been part of the Trilateral Commission all told Podesta, who's, you know, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, you're talking about us making a choice and forcing all other Asian nations to making a choice between China or you. That's going to cause World War III, and we're going to be wiped out. And they're basically just saying, like, you cannot do this. You're basically exterminating all of us, because if we make an ultimatum to other countries, they will all choose China. So why are you making us do that? And they could all see you. I mean, it really was a sense. And this is what is going on in the public in the Trilateral Commission. You can only imagine the sorts of fights that are happening behind the scenes.
Sure. Right. Right.
You know, and they're like, no, we can't make this type of choice. I'm sorry. And these are not good people. They've not been playing a noble role for the past 30 plus years of the great game. However, when push comes down to like the extermination of human civilization, while you have a viable emerging new economic structure with a very strong security outlook around China, increasingly India, Russia, Iran, all sort of creating the backbone of intercivilizational forces, all sort of agreeing that they don't want to die, that they want to create a better operating system founded upon leaping the limits to growth, mm-hmm. and utilizing those types of principles, which frankly, I only can recognize these economic and political security principles active in the 19th century leading up into World War I, as the only other time that I could see, except for what Roosevelt tried to do, but that was short-lived, and what JFK tried to do, but that was short-lived. The Cold War made a lot of this good, almost impossible. I mean, but the only other time was when the American system of political economy, utilizing this strong scientific philosophical outlook that we always need to increase the cultural standards involving scientific education, engineering education, the basic powers of logic and of reasoning and of literacy of everybody in our society, so that we can leap beyond limits to growth. It is anti-Malthusian. It does use state power. So libertarians and anarchists and don't like it at all. But it is not fascist in that sense. So it's not that it is a road to serfdom. It's not that. It's that it's based upon the principle that the government is the people, that the legitimacy of the government is in the welfare of the people. It's inextricably tied together. Unlike the fascist systems that say the people exist for the purpose of the state. That's
correct.
Different.
Correct. Yep. Absolutely.
Most people I think we've just been living under that type of fascist philosophy of Hobbesianism and utilitarianism for so long that we forgot that it's even possible to think in a more natural way about political power. We haven't experienced it. We've seen the abuse of central government, central power, banking so much to our own detriment now, as we're seeing, but also to the detriment mostly of, I mean, Africa, look at coups and economic destruction that's been waged under the IMF and World Bank of central, you know, central power of banking. It does bad. We know that this thing can do bad, but it can also do good if you have, as Eisenhower warned, an informed and educated citizenry. And I'm not here to defend Eisenhower because the guy was a disaster on so many fronts, but it was good advice where, you know, good advice is good advice. It's true. People have to recognize that they are responsible for the outcome of their national policies and the outcome ultimately of where the world is going. And to the degree that we situate our identities in those terms, we can make the types of judgments and actions that we normally couldn't do under a time if everybody thinks like a subject or a serf. Going back now to Putin has been really trying to activate this, and you can see it on especially the cultural policies by really taking aim at the psychosocial cultural opium wars that have been deployed for many, many decades now in Russia, the LGBTQXYZ thing. I mean, there is a real war right now to preserve the actual traditional cultural values of society, which are a precondition to having any type of democracy ever work. You can't have your society convinced that there's no such thing as right or wrong or good and evil or true. Maybe there's no truth because every gender is possible. If you feel like an airplane, you're sex with an airplane, marry an airplane, like that poor idiot German girl who's like 28 years old in Germany, who's like getting the laws changed of Germany so that she can marry her model airplane that right. she sleeps yeah. with at night. Like, that's a society that's not fit to survive yeah. if that's the case. So, you know, like, Putin has come out now. He's made that firm on a cultural level. You see in Xi Jinping in China, you have a revival of ancient Confucian. It's like a Confucian Renaissance, which is happening in opposition to the dumbing down and cultural nihilism that has been spread by Western media complexes since especially the 70s and 80s. But that's now, there's a big fight to do that, to limit, you know, childhood addiction to video games to 3 hours a week, effeminization of men in media and film and entertainment. That's all being cracked down upon, but it's being done with an idea, not just of going back to some like conservative feudalism, as many detractors would say. It's like, if you look at what they're doing economically, they're working to build the biggest projects we've ever seen built in human civilization's experience, which are pulling people out of poverty. Like, China had 3% of their population in middle income in 2001. 3% is, that's bad. Today, it's 53%.
Yeah, it's amazing. Right? Truly amazing.
Totally
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah.
Whereas look at the same inverse relationship in the US or Canada situation in terms of the collapse of middle income America, the small and medium businesses, which are blossoming, by the way, in China. They're now issuing more patents, intellectual patents, for creative discoveries in China than they are in the West. Now, proportionally, we're still in the lead because we're fewer in number. But the fact is, it's just gotten quantitatively higher. And there, the difference between us and them is that here, you can patent your ideas, but our society's not going anywhere, so it won't be used. Or if it is useful, the military industrial complex is going to basically, you know, suck it up and make it disappear. As the case of, you know, there's so many, Dr. Boussard, who invented the scramjet, was the father of nuclear rocket science, had developed the most efficient designs for low temperature fusion reactions back with a Polywell device, utilizing photonic and Keplerian octahedra, and recognizing that there's certain like resonances in the electromagnetic field and also in the plasmas that you can create within certain types of cube octahedron structures. And he developed that. He got funding from the US Navy and the military industrial complex. And then as soon as he started breaking the laws of physics back in 2007, it just disappeared. He got iced out. The thing just disappeared, got absorbed into the beast. So that's what we're doing. Whereas in China, you actually have the application of these discoveries and of insights into building better forms of high-speed rail, magnetic levitation rail, vacuum tube, every type of pebble bed nuclear reactor development, thorium molten salt reactor development. Everything that we're not doing or that we stopped doing back in the 70s, they're not only doing, but they're doing better than we've done. They copied. So yes, there was periods of copying like you do with any student copying a master. They are now they've gone beyond what the master was ever able to do. So for those idiotic people out there who say, oh yeah, China's only doing what they're doing because they're copying and stealing from us, Yeah, okay, that happened. We also stole from them, by the way, on a variety of things. But at the same time, they're now doing things we've never done. So explain that away, okay?
Yeah, so true. Absolutely. Yeah, so true. And versus, for example, you know, let's take the last 25 years, Matt, and think about the amount of money that the United States has spent on these endless wars. Think of how that those trillions of dollars, if that could have been utilized for development, for rail, so much better use that could have taken place here. And look, what's the net result? Where are we? Are we any better now than we were? It's just insane. And it's a vicious cycle, what's happening. And when you look at the policies, it's like, you know, all the double talk that's existing, you know, less than a month ago is like, we don't want the Ukrainians to have any weapons that are far reaching. They're going to reach into Russia. And then Biden the other day is like, well, it's okay if they do, you know, they can use the drones to do something like that. And people wonder why Russia and Putin has come forth and said, I don't see a diplomatic pathway through this. I don't see the need to have conversation anymore. And I know a lot of people are reading into it. Your thoughts on it, I guess, apparently that recently Putin postponed one of his national annual type conversation that he has with the public. And a lot of people are speculating, well, it's very telling because there's probably some other things that are happening in the background right now, which there is. And it appears it looks like they're trying to create another little chaos where maybe NATO and Russia have a battleground that's different than Ukraine. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing. There's so many things came to light in the last week. I mean, there's always this scary sword just sort of hanging over this discussion regarding the fact that Biden, all the way back in March, basically said, no, we are actually reviving Barack Obama's first nuclear use policy against even non-nuclear powers. That was there. It was re-emphasized by Biden very recently. And right when this happens, you have obviously all sorts of arsonists lighting things on fire in the Balkans. And then you have Merkel coming out saying, yeah, we've never been genuine with you whatsoever anyway. We just wanted to buy Ukraine time so that they could grow their Nazi forces. Well, she didn't say Nazi forces, but we could grow their forces to basically go to war with you. So yeah, now Putin is in a position where, yeah, his scheduled annual meeting or press conference was challenged a little bit because they have to have some serious discussions with high level, you know, officials within the Russian intelligentsia to discuss, well, how do we now communicate what our foreign policy is, because this challenges a lot of things. The good thing is that you have the Gulf Cooperation Council, which has, again, played a pretty negative role, I would say, overall, as, you know, seemingly permanent interests of the Anglo-American cartel. But they had thought maybe naively that they were friends. Nobody should ever think that they're friends with the Anglo-American death cult. They've come out and finally realized how disposable they are as simply interests who, under the current configuration of the post-oil age, will not have a role to play. And so China was able to successfully manage one of the best economic coups that I've seen. And Russia's been working on this for a long time. Both Russia and China together have been working very hard at building back-channel discussions, diplomatic, economic diplomacy, in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, also in Africa, but right now we're talking about Southwest Asia, which involves getting Iran, which has formerly been a nemesis of Saudi Arabia and a variety of Gulf states, as well as of Turkey, to get them to actually reopen up diplomatic channels and start cooperating.
Massive inroads, massive. Name a segment of the world and there's inroads taking place. You know, Cuba. Oh, man, yeah. I mean, Cuba. I mean, everywhere, right? It's like, it's just truly amazing, the economic development. And I think the writing is on the wall. I think it's very telling, the meeting between Xi and MBS. The winds of change are setting in. And just, I think the thing that I always get concerned, or I don't want to say lose sleep over, is just that what is the unipolar world willing to do? What are they willing to sacrifice in terms of because I don't think they're going to come to terms that the rest of the world is moving on without them. Mm-hmm. So I think for that reason, understanding that every effort that they put forth with Russia, the economic sanctions, the price cap on oil, everything that they've done is like just enhance and sped up the process.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best thing that they could do right now, I think, is just solidify themselves and stabilize themselves so that they be as sovereign economically as they can possibly be, with as little possible zones of conflict that could be like sparked. Because there's so many, that's how the British have historically worked, is you create as many zone spark plugs that you could choose. You know, if one doesn't work, one doesn't light, you can always go to the next. So you want to think in volume. A lot of people, they get too myopic and they get sucked into these infinite micro issues, you know, and they devote all of their time and energy into like one self-contained issue. They might get a little victory in one little battle and they forgot to think in volume, you know, like you have to think three-dimensionally here in a multi-spectrum manner, because that's how your enemy thinks. The enemy doesn't think in a linear fashion. They don't think, okay, that didn't work, let's come up with a new plan and try this. Maybe at a certain point, I mean, that is sort of what you push the uncreative mind into that place. And I think ultimately there is with all of the ingenuity of the oligarchy sort of techniques, there is ingenuity. You can't ignore that. There's a certain quality of perverse genius in that tapping to that mode of thinking. But there's still this higher cage of anti-creativity, because ultimately their fundamental drive, and this has always been the case, going back to the oligarchical systems that one can examine in the days of Babylon or of the Roman Empire, the fundamental drive is to ultimately have perfect stability, equilibrium, stasis, whereby no real new ideas could ever emerge, which challenge that stability you worship so much as a sacred thing, because it's a control freak thing. So they actually are anti-creative, ultimately. Yeah. They're not able to, and that's why there's all of these incredible, inspiring stories. If you're looking for them, you can see them throughout all of history at different parts of the world, of seemingly impossible miracles of individuals who are able to think on that higher creative level that the oligarchy only wants to reserve for their own personal initiates, who are allowed to access creativity in, you know, if you're tapped on the shoulder and you're allowed to rise in a certain level to, let's say, become a Cambridge apostle or an Oxford, you know, Rhodes Scholar, and you're brought up into the rungs, you're allowed to access that higher quality of volume thinking, top-down thinking. You're allowed to access the flexibility of utilizing irony to communicate in lateral ways. Hmm. You can utilize these types of nonlinear modes of communication, which is what, you know, human beings, I think all natural, mature human beings are destined to achieve that. The problem is when you've been victimized by an oligarchical structure of society that keeps you in a state of lower potential, you get stuck on literalisms. The oligarchy wants everybody to be able to only communicate what they immediately sense with their five senses or feel in their gut. You know, yeah. I like that cake. I like that show. And listen to Water Cooler talk at the office, right? Like,
right.
Or just repeat what smart people they heard on TV said and act like it's their own, right? That's maybe the best thing you can get. Or trivia, you know, you like, oh yeah, Jeopardy. I'm really good at Jeopardy. yeah, I must be really smart. It's like, well, Jeopardy is a bunch of like useless trivia out of context. Like that's not knowledge. It's a computer could do that too.
Right.
So, but that higher quality of thinking, when you listen to people like Martin Luther King Jr., listen to how he's composing his allegories, his metaphors to communicate broad lessons, which one could imagine volumes, thousands of books could be written documenting in treaties, documenting the philosophical purpose of living a good life and things. But he doesn't waste time with literal description. He goes for stories that carry with them metaphor, ironies, very rich lessons, which really cut through intellectual garbage and go straight to the heart where the truth actually lives. And, you know, Thomas More, Erasmus, you could read Plato's dialogues. It's all playful. People who try to read Plato's dialogues in a literal way, they lobotomize themselves and they don't understand how Plato is actually tickling your imagination to get you to think for yourself. And that's how the oligarchy always loses control. You know, you have a Benjamin Franklin who's able to organize. Usually this is not just an individual going solo. You have usually like-minded individuals who think and resonate in a certain fashion, who organize conspiracies for the good knowing what the weak Achilles heels are of this oligarchical parasite, you know, and Edgar Allan Poe exposes this in a lot of his stories. I always emphasize, if people want to get an insight into the weaknesses of the oligarchy and their inner neurotic disorder, read Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death. Read his Fall of the House of Usher. Read his Imp of the Perverse, those short stories. That'll give you a better insight into the nature of oligarchical psychology and its weaknesses than, as many treaties as you could imagine. There's so many things that have been written speculating about the mind of oligarchs. Now just read that. He gets it. It's because he's an artist. He's a poet. He's able, he's trained himself, and as well, he's a scientist. Edgar Poe went through West Point Academy. He was trained in the infinitesimal calculus. That's the whole story of Dupin, right? If you look at his Inspector Dupin, who British imperial asset Sir Arthur Conan Doyle later on plagiarized and ridiculed in the form of this idiotic Sherlock Holmes character. Dupin, in especially the Purloined Letter, Google Purloined Letter, Edgar Poe, read that little short story. He just showcases exactly how the creative scientific imagination works when employed to making a discovery and how to not fall for the traps of belief in your sense perceptions. Because the answer was right there the whole time when they were looking for that letter. The logicians, the people who were utilizing the most rigorous, extreme form of reductionist logic, couldn't come up with the answer. All the inspectors of the French police couldn't come up with the answer. But Dupin was able to figure out the key. And it wasn't through some mystical, like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, impossible, you know, almost supernatural form of discovery. Like, oh, I smelt a modicum of like 1% sulfur in the shoelaces of this character who then I associate with. No, like none of that Wolverine stuff. You know? Mm-hmm. It's like pure reason, but defined by this real creative wisdom, which the oligarchy is afraid of, which is why they killed Poe, by the way, because Poe was assassinated. He wasn't an opium addict fiend who was this horror movie like caricature. He was actually assassinated by hardcore enemies that, yeah, Eureka. Anybody who wants to get the real Poe, look at the last essay that he wrote called Eureka on his thoughts of cosmology, the moral and physical material principles of the universe. Read that essay, at least the first 20 pages of that 45-page essay. He was organizing that, was part of a series of lectures he was giving all over North America over the fraud of Aristotelian and Baconian thinking. And he actually nails in that essay the what he calls creeping and crawling. Creeping being deductive and crawling being inductive reasoning. A prioriism versus a posterioriism. A posterioriorism. The idea that your mind is only allowed to use one of these two modes of action when coming to knowledge. If you think that that's true, which is either the Aristotelian approach, believing in core blind assumptions and then building up, fitting all of your sensory data into those core assumptions, those axioms, which also comes forth in Euclid, or Ptolemy, the astronomer, another Aristotelian astronomer. They all use this. Or if you believe inversely that we can only use sensory data looking for patterns and then extrapolate patterns from our senses into what we call then universal generalities. If we believe that it's either one of those two choices or some hybrid mix of those two choices, we will think just like a binary computer, ultimately. We will not access our powers of creative imagination or reason. And he zeroes it in by actually getting at the real power of Kepler. And Edgar Allan Poe actually translated some of Kepler and infused that as a healthy remedy. Because Kepler was doing a bit of both, but he did more than that by looking at the question of the harmonic musicality of the orbits of the planets. And it was from that higher concept that Kepler was able to then demonstrate his three laws, why they were true, why there was a harmonic proportionality that defines the distances of all of the planets around the sun. Without that, you couldn't have had the development of the infinitesimal calculus a generation later by Leibniz, not Newton. You couldn't have had the development of our discoveries of electromagnetism. You couldn't have had Ben Franklin's discoveries of electricity. None of these things could have happened all the way up through the atomic age. None of Max Planck could not have discovered what he discovered on his Planck's constant. You couldn't have had that had you not had Kepler, because they all were studying Kepler and utilizing the Keplerian method, which was ironically bringing back the Pythagorean Platonic method of thinking that had been buried for 2,000 years, especially after Rome was destroyed by its own corruption internally. I'm rambling.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Yeah. I'm looking at the chat, and I know everyone appreciated that. And I think that you're spot on in terms of thinking, creative thinking, and a lot of things that have been missing for several years. But I think that we can get it back, Matthew. I think we can get back to that era where people are critically thinking through things and not just looking at things in just, you know, one perspective and understanding it. But great show today, Matthew. I want to thank you for that. Also want to thank our live listeners for tuning in. Again, if you have not done so yet, jump over. The links to all Matthew's work are in the description of this video. Check out his Substack, as well as the Rising Tide Foundation and the Canadian Patriot Review. And we will do this again, hopefully, next week. Matthew, any closing thoughts before we close out this edition of The Great Game?
I feel like I ranted so much.
No, it's all good.
I would say, take some time, tune off of social media for a day or two, read some Edgar Allan Poe and some Plato. Like, I honestly, if people really want to go for that qualitative upshift of your overarching powers and really get a better sense of where the weak spots are of the oligarchy, really, 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 I'm serious. Take the time to read, as I just mentioned, in this order. Read Plato's Apology, read the Phaedo, read the Gorgias. Just spend a few days, you know, reading these things, put it on your agenda. Read some Poe, especially Eureka, but read also, you know, I mentioned here, The Imp of the Perverse, read The Mask of the Red Death, read The Fall of the House of Usher. This is really quality. So instead of watching a movie or watching that stupid Netflix show you were going to watch, do that instead. Guarantee you better payoff, long-term good quality investments. Yeah, no regrets. Do that.
All right. Very well said. Thank you, Matthew, and everyone for tuning in. Enjoy the rest of your day.